voice probably haven't heard in a while, unless you've been listening to us. Michael Kelly Blanchard, his song Grandmother Sundays. 11 minutes after the hour, it's a Tuesday morning, and of course Tuesday is the day when Dr. Don Clark stops by, and we're pleased to welcome him to the studio. Well, not to the studios. Again, he's in Garden Valley. It just looks like he's in the studios here.
We should start saying studios.
Well,
we should studios. Start saying, we each have our own studios.
Well, I mean, we could talk about the imaginary studio complex in East Dakota.
Yeah, Radio City Complex. But mm-hmm. very deep.
We could make. I think it's now that I think about it, it's mm-hmm. it's 8 stories high. But they're all underground.
Yeah, it's underground. Yeah, it is. Well, that's best for keeping all those old records in good shape, you know.
Yeah, the top floors are just record storage.
Don Clark, biochemist. He's a member of the Board of Creation Moments. And we invite Don to come in, and we usually talk about things like creation and evolution and science and faith. And we've got a scientific topic today. And Don, you'll be delighted to know, I read a news story earlier last hour about the Chipotle Mexican Grill. They've got 1,800 restaurants across the country. Every one of them is now GMO-free. That is, genetically modified organisms have been booted out the door. And, of course, the industry said, well, you're going to raise prices. It's going to get to... And they said, no, we didn't find major price increases. They didn't increase their prices at all on the retail side. So there's a blow for... Well, Dr. Mercola, I think, would approve of that. Now, we have an article up today to talk about, and this is about not just GMO specifically, but another issue that's really connected in terms of diet, but it's antibiotic resistance. And Don, at the beginning of this article, Dr. Mercola writes about at least 23,000 people dying across the U.S. as a result of antibiotic resistance bacteria each year. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And he mentions a recent report commissioned over in Great Britain. David Cameron reported on it, the Prime Minister. He said that by 2050, their predictions are that antibiotic resistance will have killed 300 million people and an annual global death toll reaching near 10 million. What is antibiotic resistance? Explain that to us.
Well, it as the name implies, it means that you have bacteria that are no longer sensitive to antibiotics. In other words, if you treat a person that has an antibiotic resistant strain of bacteria in their system, then you will. They won't respond. They won't respond to the antibiotic. Mm-hmm. And so the question, one of the questions that comes up, well, how did the resistance get there in the first place? And then what, once we know how the resistance is getting into the population and into the general population of bacteria, for example, what do we do about it? And the other question from a creation evolutionary point of view is the bacteria resistance something that evolved, or is it just turning on or off genes that are currently in the bacteria to start with? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a broad stroked overview of antibiotic resistance, but antibiotic resistance in bacteria are certainly a major problem, not only for the U.S., but for the world in general, because of the a lot of the farming techniques that we use here in the U.S. They don't quite use the same techniques in Europe so much, but having animals in a confined space forces them to treat them with antibiotics, which and treat them with low doses of antibiotics, which then causes resistance in the bacteria that are around the animal, not only in the animals, but around the stockyard, for example. That was an interesting study was done in Lubbock, Texas, where they actually looked at, did DNA analysis of downwind material that came from a stockyard, and they found that even 200 miles away, they could still find some DNA markers for antibiotic-resistant bacteria, which means that the bacteria had traveled that far from, by being carried in the wind from either fecal matter or a combination of fecal and just feed that's getting kicked up into the atmosphere. And of course, Lubbock can be quite dry at times, so you've got a problem. They did the same study upstream, upwind from the stockyard, and didn't find they found very little of the DNA markers. So it's kind of indicating that, wow, this is definitely coming from the stockyard, and it could indeed be a problem. It was like 4,000 times the amount of antibiotic-resistant bacteria that was downwind from the stockyard than was upwind from the stockyard.
Mm-hmm. Now, this article talks about our flawed agriculture model as being responsible for breeding out-of-control drug resistance. And it's you just touched on one aspect of that. These antibiotics are in the animal's feed. Is that correct, or do they get shots? Do they get medicated separately, or is this all woven into the fabric of feeding all these animals in stockyards?
Yeah, it's typically in the feed. Mm-hmm. You can buy, even at your local feed store, you can buy medicated feed for your chickens, for example. For those of us who have chickens or game animals, game birds, you can. So they put it in at a lower concentration, and then with the hopes of, okay, this is going to take care of our problems in a concentrated animal situation, an artificial one, by the way, where you're feeding animals in a big pen, and you're feeding hundreds of animals, maybe even thousands of animals this way, especially before they go to the slaughterhouse.
This is an unnatural way for these animals to live. Where do we start on that level to fix this? I'm thinking organic here. You let them loose into pastures again, and don't concentrate them in such huge numbers, but that raises costs, and there's a trade-off, isn't there?
Well, of course there is. Mm-hmm. The answer to a lot of these problems is you're going back to small farms and local farmers who graze their animals on their fields and in inappropriate numbers. And then, if you want a side of beef, okay, he takes one of his cows and he slaughters it, or gets it slaughtered, and there you go. You got a side of beef, and so it's much healthier for you. One, it's grass fed, but two, that particular farmer is not going to feed his animals the antibiotics. One, because it's more expensive, but two, he doesn't need to, because the animals are much, much healthier in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the problem of conglomerate farms, where they have all of these animals in thousands of animals that they're trying to get ready for market, is causing this problem. But the other aspect of the problem is actually in the feed itself, not just the antibiotics that are put in the feed, but another substance that winds up in the feed. And that substance is Roundup, or glyphosate, which is used quite extensively, obviously, in corn production and wheat production, and the grains that these animals are eating. Now, what's the problem with glyphosate, or why is that exacerbating the antibiotic resistance in these animals and for the bacteria that the animals may have? Well, it turns out some recent studies have shown that glyphosate actually primes the bacteria for antibiotic resistance. In other words, the bacteria turns on genes that says, oh, I've got a foreign substance in my system, and so I need to get rid of it. And so it turns on the pumps that actually pump out the toxic or the foreign chemicals. It's similar, not exactly the same, but you could think of it as a kind of the bacteria is being immunized, if you will, against toxic substance. Well, you know, a toxic substance to an antibiotic, I mean, to a bacteria is an antibiotic. Mm-hmm. So once these bacteria have been primed with glyphosate or with Roundup, then they're much more likely to be resistant to antibiotics. Mm-hmm. That they're given. So their pump is primed, and literally they have these they're probably in the cell wall or within the cells that pump out the toxic material, and hence they can survive an antibiotic treatment.
And maybe just to define again the risk to human beings is that as we develop in our systems antibiotic resistant bacteria, that makes us susceptible to all kinds of diseases and without a way to combat them. That is, the doctors would prescribe an antibiotic, it would have no effect. And in Mercola's article, just a short paragraph, common illnesses such as bronchitis or strep throat can then turn deadly, and even routine low-risk surgeries become risky. More high-stakes surgeries like organ transplants may no longer be survivable because antibiotics are of no use. And I guess the thing is, they can develop new antibiotics, but the bacteria is becoming resistant to it so fast that it's hard to get a step ahead of the bacteria.
Well, it is, and that obviously is a problem, and it's been a problem in hospitals. And if you go to your local hospital and you happen to get one of these antibiotic resistant bacterias while you're visiting the hospital or having surgery, for example, I mean, you can survive the surgery, but you may not survive the septic condition that follows the surgery because mm-hmm. they can't treat you for the antibiotic infection that you had, mm-hmm. which in the past was easily treated by the standard antibiotics, but the standard antibiotics in many situations are no longer working. And it's being derived primarily from these two problems that I mentioned. That is the animal feed or treating these animals with antibiotics, mm-hmm. and the glyphosate problem. Mm-hmm. We pretty much 90%+ of our grains that we have. Are being treated with high levels of glyphosate.
And that was mentioned in the Chipotle article, too. It's canola, which is rapeseed, and corn, and wheat, which is almost all those things are in almost everything. Any processed food you buy has got one or more of those things in them. And maybe we can explain again. Now, this is a tie-in between this antibiotic-resistant bacteria and genetically modified organisms. So, and we've covered this before. You plant a field of corn, not genetically modified, so that you can spray the whole thing indiscriminately with Roundup and kill all the weeds, but the corn itself is not destroyed by the Roundup. Still, and Roundup is glyphosate, when that corn gets to the market and gets into your kitchen, and this is according to German researchers, glyphosate residues cannot be removed by washing. They are not broken down by cooking. Glyphosate residues can remain stable in foods for a year or more, even if the foods are frozen, dried, or processed, which means we're eating Roundup.
That's exactly right. And a lot of problems that people have, for example, with irritable bowel syndrome and many, many more, and you can find articles upon articles on Mercola's website mm-hmm. on genetically modified foods. This stuff doesn't go away, and it causes problems in our gut. It causes problems for pregnant women. Eating material that has glyphosate on it or in it, and you just read, it doesn't wash out because it is in the tissue of whatever it is you're eating. Mm-hmm. So it's in the corn, it's in the the leaves, it's in pretty much everything, and it causes it is not an innocuous substance. Glyphosate itself, one of the mechanisms of, well, it was thought that, okay, well, maybe we could use this as an antibiotic because it had some antibiotic properties. But the compound itself is actually a heavy metal or a metal chelator, and it sucks up the metals in the plant, for example, that it's being targeted against. And that's pretty much the mechanism by which it kills the plant. In other words, the plant doesn't have the heavy metals anymore, which are used in the enzymatic processes to make a new plant tissue. So the plant basically just dries up and dies. So getting that same material in your gut, well, it's sucking up metals in your intestine and causing all kinds of havoc in your intestinal lining, and also causing havoc with your natural bacterial flora that is in your intestines. And so the first type of signs of perhaps glyphosate toxicity in man is gut related or colitis related type of problems, mm-hmm. which in the past we have identified as saying, well, okay, you just have a unidentified irritable bowel syndrome. We don't know, what's causing it. But I think the more we begin to look into this, the cause is going to be, this particular compound, mm-hmm. in compounds related to it that are actually causing the problem. So the solution is to go to organic type of foods or non-genetically modified foods. And I'm thrilled that Chipotle has decided to switch from GMO products, and I hope that more of our restaurants decide that will push more of the fast foods or even just regular restaurants.
And this is an important point too. The reason that's happening is not because science has said all this is dangerous and bad, although there's some science that does, and there are studies that say GMO genetically modified organisms like corn, wheat, canola over a long period of time is detrimental to health. There are studies that confirm that. This is largely a result to the public feelings about GMO. They're saying we just don't want them. We don't trust them. So this is not the political machinery. It's not the scientific machinery rejecting GMOs and rejecting these chemicals. It's the public who says we don't want to eat them. And there's enough of us now that think that way that companies are starting to respond. They mentioned also in the article General Mills now has rejected GMOs in some of its cereals, not all of them yet. But I guess the process is underway there.
Well, that's an interesting one because General Mills was one of the companies, one of the major companies, mm-hmm. fighting against GMO labeling in California when the bill mm-hmm. came up in California to actually just label products. Look, all we want is the products to be labeled so we can make an intelligent choice. Do we want to use these or not? And that was defeated because of a strong funding campaign by companies such as General Mills and others, food companies the chemical companies didn't want that on the label because that obviously would mean that mm-hmm. people are going to not buy their products. Mm-hmm. It is interesting that now General Mills is going in that direction, which is a good thing because there's probably, as you've pointed out, more pressure now from the public as the public becomes more aware of mm-hmm. the potential dangers of these products.
So it's not like we can wait around for the scientific community to say, hey, this is killing us, and then have the politicians pass laws to stop it. That may ultimately happen, but not until enough members of the public have gone to the grocery stores and say, hey, I'd really like you to expand your organic section. I'd really like you to label things that have GMOs or not. And if enough of us do that, those are pocketbook issues, and that gets a response.
Yes, yes, and it probably gets a quicker response than, as you said, trying to pass legislation in order to help correct some of these problems.
Yeah, David, do you have a thought there?
Yeah, I was thinking. I'm wondering, and I'm trying to isolate which antibiotic, but you know, maybe just stick with glyphosates. For example, is there any suggestions or stories or evidence or possibilities that some of these large companies are going to introduce maybe a drug that would combat the bad drug, and offer that as a solution, as opposed to going back to organic farming? I guess I'm concerned that for example, here in Minnesota, 82% of the population lives in a big city. And there's just no way that unless they start putting putting gardens on every rooftop, there's no way that that organic farming can, at least in the short term or even in the medium term, be able to unhinge this great big massive food transportation machine that we've got going. That's a long-term solution. At least it seems like it almost has to be. The big food is fairly well entrenched in Washington. There are more lobbyists than you can shake a Roundup can at. They're all over the place. And I'm wondering if somebody would suggest that as an alternative to become or make their product more acceptable. I mean, people are not marching in the streets now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It hasn't reached the level of do something now. I mean, we're not Baltimore. We're not out destroying buildings. Nothing's going to happen. I wonder if there's another alternative, another way around.
Well, I think it is making the public aware of the potential the problems of these type of products. Even Roundup itself is having a problem in the farming community and farming world, as I think we've talked about on this program before, in that there are Roundup resistant weeds now that are mm-hmm. that have developed. Especially we're seeing it in the corn section of our agriculture. So instead of saying, maybe this isn't the direction we should be going in, they are now making doubly or triply modified corn, for example, that is resistant not only to Roundup, but to 2,4-D, for example, or half of Agent Orange, if you will, because that's a stronger herbicide than Roundup. And so if you combine those two resistance within the corn, for example, then we can spray the corn with Roundup, but we can also spray it mm-hmm. with a mixture of Roundup and 2,4-D and kill everything else, whereas the corn would go ahead and grow. This should be disturbing, to people that we have to go to such drastic measures to keep the weeds out of our gardens
It's a trust issue. If you go to the grocery store and you buy a package of processed food, you typically don't even think it's dangerous. You trust the grocers, you trust the system to give you healthy stuff. And I guess we need to simply open our eyes and realize that that is not necessarily the case. And it kind of takes us back to the 1900s and the controversial over foods and meats and slaughterhouses and all that. It's not like we've made a whole lot of progress. Science has kind of pasted over some of the problems, but those Band-Aids are now causing us problems in our generation and the generation to come. Another aspect of the cornfield, which you brought to mind, is when you have a bazillion acres of corn planted and there's some of it GMO corn and some of it organic corn, they tend to crossbreed, don't they? so that, that if you have a neighboring field, you can't guarantee it'll stay organic.
Well, that was a big problem because the Monsanto was sending in their researchers and saying, "Oh, you know, you're not paying us the royalty for genetically modified corn." Well, mm-hmm. and the poor farmer was saying, "I didn't plant genetically modified corn." And he said, "Well, but we have the gene markers that says that your corn is genetically modified." Well, that gene was being blown over by the pollen from a neighbor's field.
Hmm.
And so who gets penalized but the poor farmer who's trying to grow it the old-fashioned way mm-hmm. instead of the company that, you know, didn't put on their label that, gee, you got to be, 10 miles away if you're going to grow non-genetically modified corn. You've got to be 10 to 20 miles or even 100 miles away, mm-hmm. From this particular field that is, this material is being planted in. Mm-hmm. So our system has been messed up for some time, and it's not getting any better on the ag chem side of things so much. But I think making people aware, there are regions of the country which are better suited, for example, for growing organic materials, and we certainly have the transportation mechanism for getting them from one place to another. Than they are in other places. And for example, in our area, we have tried to go organic with our grape growing. It's an impossibility, at least at this point, mm-hmm. Because we have so much disease pressure from the amount of moisture that we have in the spring and early summer. That you can't control the fungus, you can't control the insects with just standard organic materials, and it's not cost effective to use that much organic fungicides, for example.
And of course, that's the core of the problem is economics. And I think until the American public is up in arms and saying don't do this, no solution will be found. I think that's going to be the motivator, is dollars. Now. Dr. McCullough makes a point in this article, and by the way, we will link this article in the podcast, so if you haven't seen it, you'll be able to go right to it after we get the podcast uploaded here. He says, it would be nice if politicians and health officials were as aggressive in tackling antibiotic resistance as they are toward a typically non-lethal childhood disease like measles. After all, antibiotic-resistant disease kills an estimated 23,000 Americans per year or more, while no deaths have been reported from acute measles since 2003. So it's a matter of priorities here. It's a matter, we all know the word measles. We fear measles. There was a scare in the 50s and with pregnant women and all that, and so we react to that emotionally, and we say protect us, but we don't understand the threat posed by antibiotic-resistant diseases. We need to spread the word.
Well, we do. And then, what do you do in the meantime? You've got all of these the bacteria, like I said, that's getting into the hospitals and everything that are antibiotic resistant. Mm-hmm. Not only people bring them in, but it could be coming in through the food source as well. And the standard, hospital practice is not enough. Some people, some hospitals, for example, in Canada, are going to ancient techniques for helping people with certain types of diseases, whether it be, an Anglo-Saxon concoction or a mixture for treating eye infections.
I read about that, yeah.
Doing something called fecal transplant to treat colitis, for example, which these things kind of sound a little barbaric, but a little bit of garlic and leeks and wine and cow bile, for example, goes a long way and was found to be 100% effective mm-hmm. against killing antibiotic resistant. Streptococcus aureus, for example, in eye infections. So maybe we should go back and look at some of these older techniques to see, you know, what is effective and what is not. And there's things that we can do, for example, is make sure that we're getting enough vitamin C. Garlic is a wonderful, not only it's an antimicrobial, it's not only an antibacterial, but it's an antimicrobial, you know, product. It kills bacteria, it kills viruses, and it kills fungus. Mm-hmm. You know, garlic is, of course, you know, readily available. Colloidal silver is another one that hasn't been necessarily proven, you know, scientifically, but they used to make medical instruments at least silver plated. And the reason is because bacteria doesn't grow on it. Mm-hmm. And so silver has a property of at least resisting or inhibiting bacterial growth and other microorganisms' growths. Olive leaf extract is another one, and you can find these, and of course, tea tree oil, some people have known about for quite some time. So there are some home remedies that will help at least boost your immune system, and I think that's the best thing that we can do. It's one of the things that we can do is to find out, hey, how can I improve my own immune system just in case I get put into a situation where, you know, I'm infected with a antibiotic-resistant bacteria. What are you going to do? Mm-hmm. Well, your own immune system can go a long way in helping you survive that situation.
Mm-hmm. But see, then you don't have to go down and buy a bottle from the pharmacist to fix it. There's the dollar issue again. We're fighting an industry that tells you need a prescription to fight that. And
you don't need to take one pill for $100, or you can eat a clove of garlic. Which would you like to do?
Yeah,
I mean, you know.
Yeah, good point. Interesting article here, and it has to do with not just antibiotic resistance, but GMOs and the systems that perpetuate what apparently is killing us, at least according to this article, 23,000 Americans a year. And according to this study in the UK, estimating up to maybe 10 million deaths a year across, you know, around the world because of antibiotic resistance. It's something we ought to at least be informed about. And I think it going down to your local grocer and saying, give me more organics, give me more GMOs, change your labeling, they can start at that level too. You know, one sign at the end of the aisle that says this is a GMO section should make it feel a little bit better. So it is public
organic
awareness
section,
or
not GMO.
A non-GMO.
Either way, if you know what's there, you can make a decision.
Yeah, so, the other way. I know. The manager over at Cub. I could just have him say, "Could you put all the GMO stuff in one corner?"
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's all in the middle.
Well, there's a hint. Yeah.
Right? There's a possibility. At least, you know, if you want to go in there, pursue at your risk. Before you go down, I wanted to ask you about the bird flu outbreak in Minnesota. And it's not just in Minnesota, but Iowa, Arkansas. There's a whole number of states that are producing turkeys and chickens. And, you know, it's an outbreak of the H5N2 strain. It's millions and millions of turkeys and chickens have been destroyed and are about to be destroyed. Is there a connection to what we've been talking about today or not?
Well, the connection is the concentrated breeding. You know, again, you've got these farms that have thousands and thousands of chickens or turkeys that, you know, they're standing next to each other. And right. So they are much more susceptible. Their immune systems aren't up to snuff. They're much more susceptible to diseases. And so one bird gets infected, the whole flock's going to get infected. Whereas if these, if the birds were out in a field, free ranging, for example, that would be they'd be healthier for one thing. And then the other thing is that they would be less likely to contaminate one another. Mm-hmm. Because they're not living in close quarters. So the agricultural farming techniques that we've been using, especially in the past probably 50, 100 years or so, of these large farms, high concentration of animals is exacerbating these problems.
Mm. And David, one movement that is underway that may address the issue you brought up, and that is long-term, mid-term, how long does it take to change, is this slow food movement. And for example, if more lawns were converted to gardens, if there were more blocks that got together to have maybe set aside one small patch of ground for a communal garden where everybody shared the labor and shared the produce and got together and cooked it the way it used to be cooked, not processed, but right out of the garden. If that happens in enough area, different areas, it could happen in big cities too. In fact, I've seen some photographs, not from the U.S., but from elsewhere and in Asia, where towering apartment buildings have gardens up and down the full height of the building. And people are growing their own produce that way. So it may be an interim solution and not a complete solution, but it might be the first step to get us there. But that slow food movement is worth researching.
In fact, right now in Detroit, this would be a great time to start inner city gardens because they got a lot of open space.
And knock down some of those old buildings and check the soil, and then grow organic produce for that block.
Plant your food.
You know, take care of yourselves that way, and don't depend on a system that apparently is forsaking you, slowly but surely. So, Dr. Don Clark is a member of the Board of Creation Moments. I don't want to forget their website. That's creationmoments.com. And you'll find lots of scientific information there on a number of things, not so much a dietary, but more to do with the young earth creation position. You'll find science that supports that there, science you don't normally get access to in the rest of the world. I think you'll find it a good place to go. You can learn a lot there at creationmoments.com. You can link to it from our website at brokenroadradio.com. Don, thanks so much. Appreciate your dropping in.
You're quite welcome. It's been a pleasure this morning, as usual.
And may you survive the rain and your grapes, too.
Yeah, that's the question.
Want to see some wine from that place this year. So.
That is the question, yeah. Will your grapes survive hurricanes and tornadoes?
Yeah.
Good question.
Don, we'll check in with you next week, okay?
All right, very good.
Bye-bye.
See you, Don.
So long.